Well, here in the second hour of the program, we're going to be reviewing Dr. Robert Schuller's book called Don't Throw Away Tomorrow. Shane Rosenthal will be our guest. He joins us here in just a moment. We talked with Robert Schuller a couple weeks ago in connection with this book, and he had some interesting things to say. Now, before we get to that book, let me tell you about a better book, to be quite frank with you. It's our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June. It's called A Lutheran Book of Prayer. Now, you won't find a lot of stuff in there about positive thinking or possibility thinking or any of that. You will find a lot of good, solid, Christian, Christ-centered, cross-focused prayer resources for you, for your family, and for your church. It's called A Lutheran Book of Prayer. It's $8.99 plus shipping and handling. Call Concordia Publishing House for more information, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or go to our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June right there on the homepage, issuesetc.org. It's called A Lutheran Book of Prayer. Shane Rosenthal is producer of the network radio program called The White Horse Inn. He's written a review of Dr. Schuller's latest book, Don't Throw Away Tomorrow, for a blog titled Between the Times, his review, Don't Throw Away Your Leftovers. Shane Rosenthal, welcome back.
Todd, thanks. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
First of all, you at the White Horse Inn had some experience with Dr. Schuller some years back, and a very high-profile interview that was done there on the program in the days of yesteryear. Tell us a little bit about your experience as a producer with Dr. Schuller.
Yeah, that was a very interesting interview back in 1992. It's hard to believe that it's over, I suppose, almost 15 years ago, where we invited him, well, through a mutual friend, he was invited onto the program. We invited him for dinner ahead of time, and we discussed what kind of program we were, that we were a Reformation program, when we'd like to challenge popular versions of Christianity in light of that assumption. He said, I'm fine with that as long as you let me respond. And he, with Dr. Schuller, you have to realize he comes from a Reformed background. He's a member of the RCA denomination, which is a mainline version of something like the Christian Reformed Church or the United Reformed Church. But it's an old Reformed denomination. He subscribes to the Heidelberg Catechism, so he has this sort of historical affinity to Reformation theology. But he has redefined everything according to psychology and self-esteem. So he has some of the terminology of Reformation terms, but he sort of reinvents them a little bit. So, Mike tried to get into that a little bit with him on the program, and of course he got very defensive, and it wound up being, in hindsight, I think there was a little bit more heat than light at the end of the day. But I do have to say, Dr. Schuller's attitude throughout the thing was, how dare you challenge me? Why was I brought into this discussion? You didn't give me the questions in advance. I'm sorry, you're a mega personality who is always catered to, and you only want softball questions. Of course, you wouldn't have done the program if you had hard questions put to you in advance. It was an interesting program. We have the transcript of that, by the way, on our website. If anybody heads to whitehorsein.org, you could just look for the faces of the White Horse Inn people, hosts, and under that is a paragraph explaining information about Robert Schuller.
All right. The latest book, Don't Throw Away Tomorrow, I don't know how many books this guy has written. What is there in this book for the devoted Robert Schuller fan that they might not find in the previous books that Dr. Schuller has written?
Well, I'm sure you get a decent number of books just sent to you in the mail as a radio personality. And as a producer, I get some of these books, and I get this book by Dr. Schuller, and I flip through it, and I'm looking for, okay, is there anything in here that's newsworthy? Is it pithy? I actually did some counting. There were about, I think, under 20 Bible references in the entire book. Under 20, but lots of quotes from Ralph Waldo Emerson and. I mean, it would really be interesting to do a ratio of quotes from pop psychology and other sources versus the Bible. But I was looking for some meat, and I couldn't find a lot of meat. What I found was a lot of just pithy sayings that he's said all over the years. You know, just the be happy attitude stuff. Keep, you know, what Casey Kasem used to say, keep your feet on the ground, but keep reaching for the stars. And, you know, what I found again and again was he kept referring to previous books. And in one section in particular, I was just floored. What he said was, how can you keep on keeping on with your hopes and dreams in a negative world, basically? And the advice he gave was 3 points. Number one, reread my first book, Tough Times Never Last, But Tough People Do. I wrote that book. I lived it. Millions of copies are out there, so he's promoting himself. And then he says, now read every page on every line of that book. So I wondered, in my little review of the book, I wondered if it was kind of like a Christian pyramid scheme where he's trying to, you know, he's trying to give himself job security. He can retire and ensure people will still buy via Amazon his older books.
Oh, so if in the latest book he refers you back for answers to life's toughest questions to his previous books.
Exactly.
Then he's pretty much going to sell all these older books in perpetuity. Yeah.
That was my theory anyway.
All right. Now, what is his... When in our conversation with him, one of the first things, the first questions I broached with him was his avoidance of the word sin. And he was very upfront. He said, I just don't use that word. He said, it drives people away. Do you find that in his latest book, Don't Throw Away Tomorrow?
No, I didn't find a lot of that at all. I didn't find a whole lot of discussion of anything. There wasn't a lot of theology in the book, frankly. Again, there was under 20 references to the Bible, and most of those were platitudes from Proverbs and just things taken out of their context that just sort of try to uphold his philosophy of self-esteem. So I didn't find that. We did encounter that when he was on our radio program back in the early 90s. Michael Horton asked him directly, about things like sin and the wrath of God and the whole counsel of God, and he actually... at one point, he actually asked Mike, Mike actually said, but the Apostle Paul does say that no one is good, no, not even one. And Dr. Schuller, no kidding, he responded, well, I just don't want to say that because I think it does an untold harm. And so he doesn't want to say what the Apostle Paul said.
Now, on the issue of the Ten Commandments, does he deal, because he likes to talk about the Ten Commandments as a blueprint for a better life. Does he deal with that issue in Don't Throw Away Your Tomorrow?
Yeah, he deals with the Ten Commandments, but again, he refers to some of his books, previous books that he wrote, and in which he said he teaches the Ten Commandments are not actually negative commands. They're positive terms, not oppressive teachings. And they show that people of all faiths can live together when we're committed to civility and kindness and compassion. That's kind of his view of the Ten Commandments. They are not sort of God's requirement for absolute perfection that only Christ can fulfill. They are sort of, it's platitudes to help you be nice to your sister.
So what does he teach when it comes to... What does he teach when it comes to this whole difference that he likes to talk about? Positive life in a negative world. What does he mean by positive? What does he mean by negative?
Well, his whole worldview is sort of, just part and parcel of that whole pop psychology, philosophy. It's that, you have to have a good mental self-image, and you have to think upbeat thoughts and... That way, you will not be a negative thinker, and so possibility thinking is not focusing on the present circumstances, but lifting yourself up to what could possibly be done. And there's certainly some wisdom and truth in that. There is certainly a positive element to, I think, the whole history of redemption. We are not to think about the current circumstances that we find ourselves in sin, but we should elevate our minds to the possibility that there is a solution, namely that Christ has solved the sins for us. Even though we can't see justification, we are to consider ourselves that there is no condemnation for those in Christ Jesus. So we have to think outside of our present circumstances and what we see with our eyes. However, he has totally redefined all those things. So we're not dealing with the biblical terms such as justification, imputation, all those classic weighty doctrinal Reformation words and terms. He has basically sometimes uses those words and injects them with just merely pop psychology. And one of the clearest places you see that in, is in his book, Self-Esteem, The New Reformation, where, in which he says, I believe that the first Reformation erred in that it was God-centered rather than man-centered.
So, correct me if I'm wrong here, Shane. According to your reading of Schuller's latest book and his other ones, you use the word that we, the proper Christian understanding of looking outside our circumstances to the objective declaration of God about us in Jesus Christ. But as I read Schuller's book, it's all about looking inside ourselves for this open-ended possibility in our life.
Yeah, there's certainly an introspective a flavor to Schuller's writings. And it really is hard because he is not, he has so moved away from reformational thinking that there is very little you know, substantive content to work through. So it's hard even for me as a person who is who does come from a Reformation perspective. It's hard for me to review the book because I there isn't a whole lot of substance here to critique.
Shane Rosenthal is our guest. He's done a review of Robert Schuller's book, Don't Throw Away Tomorrow. Shane produces the network radio program, The White Horse Inn, and his review appears on a blog called Between the Times. Shane, we spoke some time back, just a couple days back, in fact, with Kim Riddlebarger, one of your associates there at White Horse, and talked about a little bit about Robert Schuller's influence. Now, people have been making a lot of his influence over the likes of Bill Hybels at Willow Creek or the influence that he may have had over Rick Warren at Saddleback in California. How would you assess Schuller's influence past and present?
Well, I certainly think he is part of a larger trend to not rely on the Spirit's power, but to rely on your own sort of rhetorical and your abilities to keep in your frame of mind who your audience is. That's something that comes across in everything Schuller says. He's always worried about, I don't want to offend people in my audience. And that is, if you study rhetoric, that's one of the three biggest branches. You have to understand who you're talking to. Now, notice the difference between that emphasis and the emphasis of someone like Jesus who says, you know, the apostles say, Jesus, you know these people were offended when you said that? And he says, pay no attention to them. They're blind leading the blind. So there are times in which you just have to say what's true regardless of its offense. And then someone like the apostle Paul who says, I came not with wisdom and not with the wise rhetoric from the schools, but I came preaching Christ and Him crucified. There is an element to Christian proclamation that is not supposed to overly rest on the arts of the rhetoricians, that it should be a clear pronunciation of Christ and Him crucified, regardless of how that will affect the masses. And I think the Hybels school and the Schuller school and all these schools that are focusing on, we have to be careful, we have to be sensitive to not use this phrase or this biblical term in this context, that's an overemphasis on rhetoric.
You know, the Hybels and the Warrens think that they can play Schuller's game, but step back from the brink that Schuller has apparently gone over, which is, Schuller says, look, I just think the Reformation was wrong, and I think we've got to focus all upon mankind and his potential, and as he said in our interview, man is born without faith. And when pressed upon, he says he's born without faith in himself. He needs to regain faith in himself, and then he'll have godly glory. Now, the Hybels and the Warrens say, you know, we can play the game of catering to what people want to hear and staying away from what people don't want to hear, but we can draw the line and say, ah, we won't go so far. But does the long career of someone like Robert Schuller act in a way as a bellwether for where you will go if you consistently try to itching ears.
Right, right. Well, I think it was Yale professor, the name escapes me, but a Yale professor from wrote this in the 70s that, you know, in the 20s and 30s and 40s, it was Norman, you know, Vincent Peale you know, was sold to a liberal audience, but conservatives eat it up in the form of Robert Shuler. And this is it's a long trend. You have it starting from, you know, sort of liberal views that get recycled, and then the way Robert Shuler does his approach, it's not exactly the same as the Hybels and the Rick Warrens, but there are certainly elements, and one of the strong elements, not the theological core, which I think clearly we could say that Robert Shuler has should no longer be considered a Reformation theologian, given that he thinks that Reformation erred and that it was man-centered, not God-centered. There are people like Hybels and Rick Warrens out there who would consider themselves, and most people would consider them to be conservative Christians. So he hasn't jettisoned, it, you know, the bulk of Protestant theology. However, the one thing they do have in common is that they are both Christianity light. They are, it's a lowest common denominator Christianity. So that when you come into the building, you don't see the offensive things. You're comfortable, and you have pithy sayings. You have a whole service with, you know, it's a little seasoning here and there of biblical wisdom, but it's not really a place in which you come to participate in a service where you are dialoguing with God, where God is giving you all the treasures and benefits of Christ in word and sacrament. It's a totally new kind of encounter where there's a veneer of Christianity without a whole lot of substance and depth.
Now, on the subject of depth, this seemed to be a word that Dr. Shuler is very fond of. In fact, in my interview with him, he said, look, my critics, which are many, and he's aware of them, my critics just don't understand what I'm talking about. They fail to grasp how deep, they fail to go as deep as I'm going in my new, I wouldn't even call it theology, perhaps you might even call it an anthropology. And yet when you read the book, Shane, doesn't seem very deep.
Yeah, certainly if you read some of his earlier works, he goes a little deeper than he does. But this latest book is that's why I called the title of my blog review. Don't throw away your leftovers. It's basically rehashing. There's nothing new in this book, in my opinion. I think it's it's just a review. But I think it's a waste of money if you go out and buy the book. At least do what he suggests. Go to your used bookstore, pick up an earlier copy of his book, and read that first. Because that's what he recommends in this book.
two things confuse me. First of all, for Shuler, and Kim Riddleberger pointed this out in a previous conversation on the subject, for Shuler, the word sin automatically triggers, for Shuler, the picture of kind of the hellfire and brimstone fundamentalist.
Right.
The all law with no gospel, and the accusing finger of the Pharisee pointing at the unbeliever saying, as he said in our interview, you don't preach to people, I've got it and you don't. Even though I had just said to him, hey, I am the sinner in need of Jesus, he turned that around and said, you can't tell people they're sinners. No, I'm mm-hmm. saying, I'm a sinner. No, you can't say they're sinners.
Right.
I was very confused by his foil.
Yeah, I wonder what kind of preaching he sat under as a child, because he does, I wonder if he just didn't get a diet of, you know, scolding. You know, have you ever seen the movie Pollyanna?
Yeah.
Carl Malden plays this preacher who scolds week after week after week, and he's the people say, oh, you know, what are we going to do tomorrow? Oh, we're going to go to church, and they all get sad faces. And, you know, why are you getting sad faces, says Pollyanna? Oh, it gives a sour stomach. You know, and there is a kind of unhealthy Christianity with an overemphasis on all those terrible images of wrath and damnation, and without any hope, sometimes a minister will scold you to the point where it causes psychological harm. And I wonder if that isn't the kind of preaching he was raised in. It may not be, but that certainly could be a reaction. The other reaction, though, in that movie Pollyanna, is that Carl Malden, because little Pollyanna says, hey, have you ever thought about the fact that there are so many more passages in the Bible that speak of love? And so then he turns into this liberal, and he doesn't speak anything about the wrath of God or sin anymore. He just decides to speak all about God's love and kindness. And the problem is, you need to have both, because if you don't have the sin and the wrath, it doesn't give you the context to show you why the love of is meaningful, or you know, it is without context. God's mercy applies to the fact, and it is wonderful mercy given the context that He could damn us all if He was pleased to do so, because we all merit His wrath.
What does the sparse use of Holy Scripture in Schuller's latest book, what does that tell you, Shane?
It tells me that he's not really a minister of word and sacrament here. He is he's mostly a storyteller, telling me about, you know, a lot of ideas out there in popular culture and in various worldviews and in stories about Mother Teresa, etc. But he's not really sharing with me the message of the Bible. He's not a Bible teacher primarily. And when you do see the Bible passages that he does communicate, they are certainly not Christocentric. They are not telling me about the great story that defines our stories.
I noted as well, as you did just now, the I think almost complete absence of the cross, the message of Christ for sinners in his death and resurrection in Schuller's latest book, which makes one wonder initially whether it could be called Christian, should be published under a Christian title at all. But when I asked him in the interview about how prominent is the cross in your theology, he was utterly confused. He said, well, look, you're missing my point. My point is about man has lost godly glory. He needs to regain confidence in himself. Is that pretty typical of what you might find in most of Schuller's books?
Right, yeah. There is not an emphasis on the theology of the cross. In order to have a theology of the cross, you sort of have to... I think what you just said there may indicate actually that he leans toward a theology of glory. In order to have a theology of the cross, you have to have an awareness of suffering, and that suffering sometimes is something that God has purposed for you, or minimally has purposed as the cure for in the history of the world. That is, the suffering of Christ is the pivotal point of human history, and sometimes we are called as Christians to share in that suffering. That is, we are given our own suffering, that we are to take up our cross and share in suffering as kind of like an inoculation for heaven, and we are brought into that. But that kind of theology has no part in the worldview of Dr. Schuller, in my opinion.
With only 20 seconds here, what's the appeal, if there still is an appeal, of Robert Schuller's teaching and preaching?
Well, I think it's a positive message, and you know, the masses love to tune in to his message on TV, and always beware. When a message is very, very popular, that for Christians should not be, I mean, that's pragmatism to say that it must be good because so many people love it. Something should be suspect if that many people are really saying, hey, that's got to be a great message. And the fact that it has very little biblical weight and support should be something of concern for all Christians.
Shane Rosenthal, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, we're going to talk about The Simpsons with Dr. Gene Edward Veith.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, etc.
Martin Luther writes this: next to the preaching of the gospel, in which God speaks with us and gives us all his grace and blessings, the highest and foremost work we can do is to speak with him through prayer and receive from him what he gives. By our prayer, we seek and find what we are to receive. While many books claim to be about Christian prayer, or to offer a form of prayer, our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June, A Lutheran Book of Prayer, is a genuine prayer book. Prayers, psalms, and other resources for your daily prayer life. To order A Lutheran Book of Prayer, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or go to our website, issuesetc.org. 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June, Lutheran Book of Prayer, or our website, issuesetc.org.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Health clinics that receive federal funding are allowed to prescribe contraceptives to minors without telling their parents. Oklahoma Senator Tom Coburn and Missouri Congressman Todd Akin have introduced legislation that would put a stop to the subversion of parental rights. Bill Wilson has more.
Senator Tom Coburn tells the story of an Oklahoma father who inspired the Parents' Right to Know Act.
And he had tears running down his eyes. He actually interrupted the town hall meeting. And he said, Congressman, I got a question to ask. He said, in this sack is oral contraceptives and condoms and spermicide. They were given to my 13-year-old daughter today at a clinic. And he says, how is it that my government is taking away the right for me to care for my child?
Congressman Todd Akin says parental permission is required for minors to have their ears pierced, but not for contraceptives.
And yet we can give drugs that can literally, under certain circumstances, threaten the life of a child. And it is illegal to allow the parents to know.
This new legislation will prevent the government from promoting secrecy between parents and their daughters. Florida Congressman Tom Feeney.
In my view, there are a lot of things that the federal government must do. There are a lot of things that the federal government can do, and there are a lot of things that the federal government should never do. Coming between the relationship between a mom and a dad and their adolescent daughter is something the federal government should never, ever do.
The bill requires 5 days parental notice before contraceptives are prescribed to minors. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bill Wilson in Washington.
The Parents' Right to Know Act has strong bipartisan support in both houses of Congress, and Senator Coburn expects it to pass. More than 70% of Americans support parental notification laws, according to several recent polls. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Have you tried and failed to live a purpose-driven life? Do your attempts to live a life that is pleasing to God fall so far short that you'd rather stay home from church? Then join Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, where the focus isn't on you, but on Christ, who was made sin for us, that we might become the righteousness of God in Him. Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church is located at 612 North State Street in Freeburg. Their phone number, 618-539-5664.
Don't let the title fool you. You don't have to be Lutheran to benefit from our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June. It's titled The Lutheran Book of Prayer. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about the Lutheran Book of Prayer on our website, issuesetc.org. The Lutheran Book of Prayer costs $8.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. During this half hour, going into the third hour of the program, we're going to be talking with Dr. Gene Edward Veith, a regular guest on the program and culture editor for World Magazine, about a cover story he recently did titled Homer's Odyssey. Now, it's not about this classic of Greek literature. It is about something far more mundane, popular, and something you can and could have seen on television for the last 10 years or so. The Simpsons. We're going to be talking about The Simpsons as satire on both American culture, but especially on American religion as well. Dr. Gene Edward Veith joins us. You can join us as well, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Veith, in addition to being a regular guest, is director of the Chronic Institute, a Lutheran voice in the public square, culture editor for World Magazine, and author of this cover story for a recent edition of World, Homer's Odyssey. Dr. Veith, welcome back.
No, thanks for having me again.
For someone who might have been living under a rock for the last 10 years or so, introduce that person to this phenomenon, which is known as The Simpsons.
Well, The Simpsons is a cartoon show written really for adults, and it's been around actually for 15 years, and it just passed its 350th episode. And since they have cartoon characters instead of actors who want to get in the movies and go on with their lives, it just keeps continuing and continuing. And it's on every day, several times a day, really, on the different cable channels and such. But it's about a family in a mythical Springfield, city named Springfield. Homer is a really stupid but kind of good-hearted guy as the father, and he's married to Marge with the tall blue hair, who is his long-suffering wife. They have Bart, who's an obnoxious little brat, and Lisa, who's an idealistic little girl who wants to save the whales and do everything in a politically correct way. And then there's the baby who just sucks her pacifier and doesn't say anything. And that's the family. And out of that family, he's around them, he's built all kinds of kind of quirky and humorous characters, from, you know, Krusty the Clown and the evil owner of the nuclear power plant, Mr. Burns, and a whole cast of scores and scores of characters. And it's become one of, well, some people actually call it the best show on television. Some say it's the best television series of all time. It's very funny, it's very hilarious, but it's very controversial. Some people, you know, will never miss it. Other people totally forbid their children from watching it. And in a way, both sides have a point.
So how would you classify it as someone, you spent quite a number of years teaching English at the college mm-hmm. level. How would you classify it as a piece of pop Americana? Is it satire? Is it open ridicule? What is it?
Well, it's satire, and that's a form that a lot of people don't really understand. And in the classical literary theory, satire was seen as one of the most moral of literary forms, because what satire does is to ridicule vice, to ridicule bad behavior. And so in a satire, the idea was this is a moral form, because when you're presenting someone doing something bad in a way that they're so ridiculous that you're laughing at them and scorning them, that you don't want to be that way. You don't want to do the kinds of things that would make people laugh at you and make fun of you. And in fact, that's said to be more of a deterrent to vice than you know, stern exhortations. You don't want to be held in contempt. And so a lot of the satires throughout literature are about people doing bad and ridiculous things. And some people look at the bad and ridiculous things and say, oh, well, that's immoral literature. In some of Shakespeare's comedies, and going back to Plautus, you know, the character of a henpecked husband or an unfaithful husband, and he's presented as the butt of the jokes. Now, some people say, oh, this is immoral because look at all the immoral content it has. But what you have to look at is, what is the effect of it? Does it make you want to be immoral, or does it make you want to be moral and to hold the bad behavior in contempt? So satire is a very moral form of literature, and a lot of what makes The Simpsons funny is satire that very often hits a target.
One of the targets of satire very often, and you've noted it, many others have noted it in this animated series, The Simpsons, is religion, in particular pop American Christianity. Here's a sample.
And now please rise for our opening hymn, In the Garden of Eden. By I, Ron Butterfly.
In the Garden of Eden, honey, don't you know that I love you? In the Garden of Eden, baby, don't you know that I'll always be true?
March, remember when we used to make out to this hymn?
Okay, that's just a little bit of the typical Simpson experience in church. Dr. Veith, what's being said here about pop American Christianity?
Well, I can't help but laugh about it. It's great that you got those clips. who we hear is Reverend Lovejoy, who's the preacher of a big mega church, and all the people in Springfield gather together every Sunday in that church. But they're trying to be very relevant, and they're trying to, Reverend Lovejoy tries his hardest to be very, you know, hip and with it. And so taking the old rock song in the Gata da Vida and turn that into in the Garden of Eden, as he does there, well, the satire, and it's so funny, is that it's making fun of that attempt of Reverend Lovejoy to be relevant, to make his church relevant. And, of course, it's all he manages to do is to make it ridiculous.
And I find it interesting that, and this happens so very often in The Simpsons, when they talk about the church life in particular of The Simpsons, to poke fun at attempts at on the part of the church to be with it. And you get Marge and Homer giggling there about how they used to make out mm-hmm. to this hymn.
Of course, it was the old Iron Butterfly song that was so big back in the 70s. But, of course, you know, what that's showing is that a sacred song? Is that, can that work as a hymn? And you can argue and argue and get into all these debates about it, but if you hear that clip from The Simpsons and you start laughing at the thought of In a Gata da Vida being used as a hymn, the whole argument is just made, and it's almost irrefutable. And that's the power of satire.
The characters on The Simpsons, in particular the Simpson family, but every character is in church. They're all sitting in church on Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm.
But the Simpson family, while not very pious perhaps, are deeply enmeshed in the Simpsons world's version of Christianity. What is the picture that's portrayed of Christianity? Does it purely poke fun at this and other religions?
Well, It pokes fun at just about everything in The Simpsons, one way or another. Liberals, conservatives, every shade of belief, they all get take their licks in The Simpsons. But most of the religion in The Simpsons, though, is the, you know, good people go to heaven, bad people go to hell kind of religion. Better description of it, and something I've read lately, being described now as moralistic therapeutic deism. In other words, religion is all about being good. In The Simpsons, they often have the picture of God, you know, zapping people with thunder when they do something wrong, thunderbolt when they do something wrong. It's therapeutic. Oh, well, religion, this is going to help solve our problems. And a lot of times the sermons of Reverend Lovejoy are just sort of pop psychology, feel-good kind of sermons. And deism, God is up above, you know, zapping us when we do something wrong. But Christ is almost never mentioned in The Simpsons. The fact that a religion where God comes down into our sinful human condition, bears our iniquity, and gives us forgiveness, that's what Christianity is really about. That really is almost never brought up in The Simpsons. And so the kind of religion that they're making fun of is really this generic American moralistic therapeutic deism kind of religion, this kind of pop Christianity that really has very little resemblance to the real thing. That's what is usually satirized, and rightly so.
Very interesting. This was on, I think, one of the newest episodes that just aired on Sunday night. And I wasn't working on Sunday night because it was Father's Day, and stayed home, and we watched The Simpsons. And it was one of the few times I can remember in watching this for years and years where actually the character of Jesus makes an appearance.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some terrible fumes being emitted from something. They were seeping into the Flanders house next door to The Simpsons. They're very devout,
mm-hmm.
hyper-Christian type of people. The little boys are on the bed saying, "Daddy, the fumes are making us cough." And the father, Ned Flanders, says, "Don't worry, Jesus won't let the bad fumes hurt us." And then they all flop over unconscious on the bed, and there's a Jesus character floating there in a vision next to them saying, "That's right, Ned, you just lay down and take a nap, and I'll go get us some Kool-Aid," or something like that. Does it cross the line?
Well, I don't know. Sometimes I think it does cross the line. And, you know, it's one thing to satirize to ridicule vice, it's another time to ridicule virtue. And it's not reverent, and sometimes I think it does cross the line. And yet, what is being satirized in that scene is that, now, I don't think that Jesus should be brought in at all, but it's satirizing that therapeutic model of Christianity, that, Jesus will help us, he won't let anything bad happen to us, and that kind of sanitized version of, you know, positive thinking, that kind of Christianity that doesn't deal with suffering, even though Jesus himself suffered more than anyone, and that he joined us in our suffering. It's that kind of sentimentalized kind of Christianity that even in that scene, although I wish they would just leave our Lord's name out of it, but what's being satirized in that scene is not any kind of authentic Christianity, but somebody's sentimental version of it.
It kind of raises a question, and that is, we were watching this as a family. And that was one that, while Dad laughs at The Simpsons on a regular basis in the Wilkin household, that was one where, you know, I didn't want to laugh at an image of that was clearly Jesus there. And as funny as the gag was, with my 9-year-old sitting next to me, because he doesn't understand satire.
Yeah.
Is this for kids?
No, it's not all for kids. And I think the misconception we have is that it's a cartoon. And for years and years, we've associated cartoons with children's fare. But really, that's not true. And as the generation that grew up on the cartoons has reached adulthood and went into middle age, you're still watching cartoons. But the cartoons on television, Simpsons, King of the Hill, the Family Guy, and all of these others, they are emphatically not for kids. They're for adults. The level of humor they aspire to is such that adults can get it, but children who don't have this developed sense of irony, a lot of the satire is missed. I remember when The Simpsons first came out, at the very first they focused on Bart, and Bart is a really, you know, obnoxious little kid, and, you know, he would wear T-shirts like, or he had slogans like, you know, underachiever and proud of it. And I remember when their kids' school, they've had to ban Bart Simpson T-shirts because a lot of kids were mouthing the things that Bart would say, which in the context of the satire were humorous, but the kids were picking up this bad attitude and, you know, thinking it was all right to say that. And so I can see the school wouldn't want kids to be wearing underachiever T-shirts. That just wouldn't go with the climate that the school wants to create.
But that's an issue of, I think, what you have talked about many times on this program, Dr. Veith, context, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And understanding meaning. And the meaning of something, whether it's a TV show or some other work of art, is determined by the context and by the effect that it has on someone. And if a child is watching something like this and picks up that bad attitude, then that's creating a problem, and it's having a very negative effect, and it's having a very negative meaning. Another person might catch the joke and find that it's humorous or even moral in the sense of making fun of some bad behavior that needs to be ridiculed. But for somebody that doesn't get that distinction, they're missing the meaning, but it's having a negative effect. Again, it's not relativistic to say that a particular show can be taken in many different ways, but you just have to be sensitive to how it is being taken.
Dr. Gene Edward Veith is our guest. We're talking about The Simpsons. Feel free to join our conversation. 10 more minutes in this conversation with Dr. Veith. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. Coming up in about 10 minutes, by the way, in the third hour of the program, we'll be talking with Dr. Daniel Garden, beginning our series on Christ in the Old Testament. We'll start in a what seems like unlikely place, 1st and 2nd Chronicles. Dr. Daniel Gard, beginning that series with us, Christ in the Old Testament, in about 10 minutes on Issues Etc. Tell us about the character Ned Flanders. He is not the only Christian, of course, but he is a unique kind of Christian on the Simpsons program.
Yeah, he is. Homer can't stand him. But the interesting thing about Ned, and in many ways he's kind of the stereotypical evangelical, always witnessing and having Christian plaques in his house. But it's been pointed out, most depictions of Christians in the secular media are negative, and Christians tend to be portrayed as hypocritical. Ned is not hypocritical. He is a good neighbor. He is kind. He's always saving Homer's life in many episodes. He's very selfless. And yes, they make fun of him, but a lot of what they're making fun of is Homer's hostility to him. His very goodness just sends Homer right up the wall. But Ned, in many ways, Ned and his family are one of the few examples on television where he really presents him, where he represents someone who's a Christian, though often they're laughing at some of the things that he does and the way he's taken. It's sympathetic. I was talking to some of the people involved in making the show, and they said that the writers really have an affection for Ned Flanders. There's a kind of respect for him, even as in many ways he's a fish out of water in that show.
What about the Reverend Lovejoy? He is not the only, but certainly the most prominent member of the clergy that makes an appearance on The Simpsons, and of Christian clergy.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, he's not portrayed so positively. He drones on and on in that kind of stereotypical Southern preacher's accent, putting his parishioners to sleep. And yet he tries so hard to make his message relevant, even though there's not much there. And when he tries to, as in that clip that you played, it becomes ridiculous. And in Easter, so they go to church on Easter, and Reverend Lovejoy says nothing about Christ and the resurrection and the meaning of Easter, but his sermon is about chocolate bunnies. And again, that's American religiosity. It's a kind of a church without Christ. When at one point Homer has serious problems, so he goes to the, or no, Ned has serious problems. He actually starts doubting his faith in one episode, and he goes for spiritual guidance, and all Reverend Lovejoy has to give him is a book of quotes from Art Linkletter. Again, he refuses to give the Christian the Christian answers, the Christian message. He goes on, and he just doesn't realize just how boring and irrelevant he really is. And all his attempts to make himself relevant and not boring just make it worse.
You mentioned this just a moment ago in passing, but tell us about the people that you talk to for your World Magazine article, Homer's Odyssey, who work with the show, many of whom are Christians.
You know, that's right, especially the artists. And I had heard, and that was part of what I wanted to dig into with a story, that a number of the artists on the show are very strong Christians. And so I was able to talk with some of them, and sure enough, that's the case. Okay, this is their calling, their vocation, their secular vocation. Working on a very popular television show, drawing the cartoons. It's interesting. Some of them talk about working in the Christian imagery. And if you look at the background of a lot of the shows, you'll see the fish plaques. And Ned's decor is right on target with the Christian symbols everywhere. But sometimes it goes deeper. I know there was one show with a science fair. Lisa was there at a science fair. And a sign on one of the other exhibits talked about evolution, a theory taught as fact. And again, it's a big satirical rib on evolution and how it's taught. But again, that's worked into the background, into the visuals of the show. But some of them talked about the very active, they've had Bible studies, the people that work on that show. And one of them told me how he became a Christian thanks to the witnessing of one of the other cartoonists on the show. And so, yeah, this kind of odd spectacle, this kind of outrageous show going on, and yet for the people working in their callings, there's some actual Christian witness going on behind the scenes.
Does it strike you as odd that this subtle, this affectionate satire of both American culture, but especially of pop American Christianity, comes across in the most fanciful form of entertainment we have nowadays, which is this animated sitcom? That it's not live actors up there portraying real life, but in fact, kind of the flight of escapism that we all have on Sunday nights.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a cartoon can exaggerate things to effect in maybe a freer way than live action can. I mean, The Simpsons can actually bring God into the story. Sometimes Bart will pray, and then the prayer will be answered, and there's a snow day, and he gets out of school for a whole day. And the cartoon kind of, I think, lets the imagination have a freer rein in many ways, and especially for comedy. It is a funny show, for good or for bad. It's very hilarious in a way that sitcoms, I think, sometimes fall short. They become too realistic and too easily, I think, offensive. Whereas the cartoon form lets the creators kind of dance around things in some different ways.
Dr. Gene Edward Veith, thank you very much for being our guest.
All right, my pleasure.
Dr. Gene Edward Veith is director of the Cranach Institute, a Lutheran voice in the public square. He is culture editor for World Magazine, and he is author of a cover story in a recent edition of World Magazine titled Homer's Odyssey. You can read it on the website for World Magazine, worldmag.com, worldmag.com. Look for that there under the name of Dr. Gene Edward Veith and the title Homer's Odyssey, about The Simpsons. When we come back from this break, Hour 3 of Issues, Etc., we're going to be talking with Dr. Daniel Gard about Christ in First and Second Chronicles. Why? Well, there's a good reason. It begins our series on Christ in the Old Testament that's coming up right after this in the third Hour of Issues, Etc. ¶¶